In 2010, chemist Lee Cronin saw a demonstration of 3D printing while attending a conference in London. The technology caught his attention. At his own lab, he was always having to fabricate equipment. So he wondered, could 3D printers solve this problem? Cronin returned to the University of Glasgow, where he was a professor, and organized a feasibility workshop. It didn't take long to discover that bathroom sealant, the kind available in any hardware store, could be used as raw material, letting him print test tubes and beakers in any size or shape. He also found that the printer could be used to create simple molecules. By filling it with chemical inks, the reagents from which molecules are built, Cronin prototyped a rudimentary chem printer. Since then, Cronin has moved past formulating simple molecules and into more complicated compounds. His short-term goal is to figure out how to print over-the-counter medicines like ibuprofen. His long-term goal is to create a set of universal inks capable of making any drug from scratch. Almost all drugs are made from simple molecules like carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, Cronin explains, as well as easily available materials like paraffin and vegetable oil. With a 3D printer, it should be possible that with a relatively small number of inks, you could actually make any organic molecule. This discovery would make prescription drugs downloadable, allowing anyone anywhere access to the medicines they need. But it will do far more than that. Of course, says Cronin, this printer will also lead to new frameworks for discovery and increase the possibilities of new kinds of mind-altering drugs. While all manner of psychoactive plants are available online, allowing the adventurous to distill potent psychedelics with little more than a crock pot, some mason jars, and a turkey baster, the DEA and Interpol can still shut down these gray market suppliers. But Cronin's 3D drug printer renders that kind of oversight almost impossible. After all, how can you regulate access to controlled substances when the raw materials have become as pedestrian as paraffin wax and vegetable oil? What's more, 3D printers have user-friendly interfaces, so all that's required to work one is the ability to point and click a mouse. And they're inexpensive, so using them doesn't require big grants or costly labs. Their combination of simplicity and affordability puts every step of the chemical formulation process within reach of anyone with an internet connection and a power outlet. So for those interested in taking one of the formulas from Shulgin's cookbooks and modifying it to create the next great alphabetamine, simply hit print. And Cronin's 3D chem printer isn't the only development reshaping pharmacology. By treating the four letters of the genetic alphabet like the ones and zeros of computer code, synthetic biology gives us the ability to program living cells with the same ease that we program computers. And once the code looks right, send it to a DNA synthesizer, and within a few days you'll receive a freeze-dried vial in the mail, filled with your genetic creation. Not surprisingly, synthetic biologists have already figured out how to use this process to produce psychoactive substances. In August 2014, researchers at Stanford announced they had genetically engineered yeast to produce the painkiller hydrocodone. Conventionally farmed, poppy plants take about a year to grow enough opium to make this drug. But this new yeast can do the work in days. The Canadian company Hyacinth Bio, meanwhile, is engineering a different yeast to produce THC and cannabidiol, two of the active ingredients in marijuana. This is really just the beginning, explains Autodesk distinguished researcher and synthetic biologist Andrew Hessel. Pretty much any substance made by a plant, tree, or mushroom, including all the neuroactive substances, is within reach of synthetic biology. We're not there yet, but within a decade or so, this one technology should be able to tickle all the same receptor sites in the brain that mind-altering substances impact. Author Michael Pollan argued that the botany of desire, the idea that intoxicating plants shape us as much as we shape them, has played an unsung but important role in the evolution of culture. But no matter how influential these plants may have been, historically, our ability to use them has been held in check. If the plant didn't grow nearby, if it wasn't on the list of socially sanctioned substances, potential explorers were out of luck. Pharmacology is such a potent force for ecstasy because it changes the nature of this game. With chemical cookbooks, rigorous neuroscience, crowdsourced lexicons, and now democratized means of production, we're freed from the geographic and cultural limitations we inherited. By giving us access to not just the botany of desire, but the molecules of desire, we can continue to shape these compounds even as they inevitably shape us. It's coevolution, compressed from millennia into minutes. Chapter 7. Technology. Dean's Dark Secret. The why was never in question. What happened? How it happened? Those answers remain unclear. But the why? For Dean Potter, it was never in doubt. It was May 16, 2015, in Yosemite Valley, California, a nice spring evening, right on the edge of dusk. Potter, a record-breaking rock climber, slackline walker, and wingsuit flyer, got ready for the evening's adventure. He was 3,500 feet above the valley floor, standing on the summit of Taft Point. Alongside his friend and fellow flyer Graham Hunt, considered one of the best young pilots around, their goal was to leap off the edge, zip across the canyon below, and sail through a V-shaped notch in a neighboring ridge, above an ominously named cliff, Lost Brother. Dean Potter played an important role in the writing of Rise of Superman. He was a good friend of the Flow Genome Project, a member of our advisory board, and as big-hearted and thoughtful as any professional athlete we've met. In 2013, when we were filming the Rise of Superman video series, Dean told the story of how he nearly died while base jumping into a deep cave in Mexico. He finished tellingly, "This year, 20-something wingsuiters have lost their lives. Dying's not worth it. I've been struggling with that a lot. I don't want to be that guy who got lucky. And I've been that guy who got lucky for a lot of years. I want to be that guy that's such a wizard of strategy and knows myself and am comfortable enough to say, 'Nah, I'm not going. I want to live.' But that early evening in Yosemite, he went anyway." Graham and Dean launched off Taft Point. 40 seconds later, their flights were over. Both men came into the notch low, possibly because the colder, denser winds that arrived with the setting sun had cost them altitude. Potter never wavered, but Hunt, as far as anyone can tell, jerked left, then swerved right, putting him on a diagonal path and directly into the canyon's far wall. Potter made it through the notch, but didn't have the height he needed, and crashed into the rocks on the other side. Both men died on impact. And to this day, the details of the accident remain mysteries. No one knows what caused Hunt to swerve. No one knows exactly how Potter lost so much altitude. But the why was never in question. "Look," Potter once explained, "I know the dark secret. I know my options. I can sit on a cushion and meditate for 2 hours, and maybe I get a glimpse of something interesting. And maybe it lasts 2 seconds. But I put on a wingsuit and leap off a cliff, and it's instantaneous. Whammo, there I am, in an alternate universe that lasts for hours." And for flow junkies who get their fix through action sports, this has always been the dark secret. Ecstasy only arises when attention is fully focused in the present moment. In meditation, for example, the reason you follow your breath is to ride its rhythm right into the now. Psychedelics overwhelm the senses with data, throwing so much information at us per second that paying attention to anything else becomes impossible. And for action and adventure athletes seeking flow, risk serves this same function. "When a man knows he is to be hanged in the morning," Samuel Johnson once remarked, "it concentrates his mind wonderfully. By 2015, wingsuiting was providing exactly that kind of dangerous focus. "I start to shiver and wonder if what we're doing is right," Dean wrote in an essay just a month before his death. "Wingsuit base jumping feels safe to me, but so many flyers have lost their lives this year alone. There must be some flaw in our system, a lethal secret beyond my comprehension." The lethal flaw is that, for many, using high-risk sport to explore ecstasy is so compelling and rewarding that it becomes an experience worth dying for. Steph Davis, Potter's ex-wife and a professional climber and wingsuiter herself, has lost two husbands to the sport, yet she keeps flying. The siren song of "Hours in an Alternate Universe" that Dean sought has continued to beckon to pilots convinced they can dodge the rocks. But for the rest of us, those with lives and wives and things that matter, are we shut out of these alternate universes? Do we have to make an impossible choice between dedicating decades to practice or accepting intolerable risks to get there faster? Thanks to inventors like skydiver Alan Metney, the answer increasingly looks like no. Metney began his professional life as a lawyer at Vinson and Elkins, a global firm that counts senators, U.S. attorneys general, and Fortune 100 CEOs as alumni. But the legal life didn't do it for him, so he chucked it for his true passion, jumping out of airplanes. He pitched a tent at a local airport and began training relentlessly, logging more than 10,000 jumps and earning 3 U.S. national championships and a world championship in formation flying along the way. But Metney wasn't satisfied. He wanted to find a way to train even harder, so he started tinkering with giant fans and wind tunnels. By the early 2000s, he'd perfected an indoor skydiving experience indistinguishable from true freefall. Suddenly, competitive teams could log hundreds of hours training together in absolute safety. With this one innovation, the standard of excellence at the elite level changed nearly overnight. Even SEAL Team 6 came to work with Metney. Not to learn how to jump out of airplanes, they have that part down cold, but to train teamwork, group flow, and the secret to flipping the switch while falling through space together. "Around the world," Metney said, "it doesn't matter what culture, language, or faith, everyone has the same dream, to fly." So he built a company, iFly, and set out to fulfill that dream, one wind tunnel at a time. Today, iFly is in 14 countries with over 54 tunnels and revenue nudging 10 figures. Thousands and thousands of people who would never have considered jumping out of a perfectly good airplane or leaping off a cliff in a wingsuit have realized that dream and done so safely. By taking out the risk, iFly has taken a sport once reserved for daredevils and made it accessible to everyone, ages 3 and up. And skydiving isn't the only high-risk pursuit that has undergone a revolution in accessibility. Across the action sports industry, advancements in technology are providing safer and easier entry into the zone than ever before. Powder skiing, with its utterly magical sensation of floating down a mountain, used to be the rarefied domain of top athletes. Today, extra-fat skis make that float available to anyone who can link two turns together. Mountain bikes, which once offered bone-rattling descents to all but the best riders, now have supple front and rear suspensions, oversized balloon tires, and an ability to roll over the most daunting terrain. Even kitesurfing, best known on the internet for its kite-mare footage of people getting dragged by giant sails across highways, has mellowed. Better safety gear lets newcomers find the balance between wind and waves with a fraction of the exposure and learning time. This trend of technological innovation providing wider and safer access to altered states isn't limited to adventure sports. As we'll see in the rest of this chapter, it's showing up across many disciplines, allowing more people than ever before to sample what these experiences have to offer. We're shedding some light on Dean's dark secret, sparing many of us the stark trade-offs that he and so many other pioneers were forced to make. Technology is bringing ecstasy to the masses, allowing us to taste it all without having to risk it all. Things that go boom in the night. For nearly 50 years, Tony Andrews has been messing with your mind. If you go out at night, to concerts or clubs, he's been there, hidden from sight perhaps, but tinkering with your head. If you've ever visited the Grand Ole Opry, or the Royal Albert Hall, or, for that matter, Space, the iconic Ibiza club voted best in the world, he was in that mix too, fine-tuning your brain with incredible precision. Andrews's trade is audio. Technically, he's a sound engineer who makes loudspeakers. He's the co-founder of the British speaker company Function One. And while the name may not be familiar, it represents a half century of sonic innovation and the quest for what Andrews has come to call the audio moment. The audio moment is an instant of total absorption. It's the point, explained Andrews in a recent talk, when you get really involved in the music, when you suddenly realize that you've been somewhat transported to another place, when you find yourself experiencing more of yourself than you realized was there in the first place. Andrews's original audio moment took place when he was 9 years old. His mother had brought home a copy of Elvis Presley's Hound Dog. When she put it on, immediately, Andrews felt the shift. I was feeling all this electricity in my body, and I didn't understand what it was, but I knew it felt good, and I've been pursuing it ever since. By the time he was 16, Andrews was tinkering, building his own tweeters and cabinets, and testing out new ideas. One day, for instance, he placed a loudspeaker in the corner of their garage with the speaker facing inward, so the sound shot straight into the intersection of the wall and floor. The high notes in the mid-range vanished, but the bass was booming. So Tony designed a speaker surrounded by three walls, which looked a little like the bell of a trumpet. It was the discovery of horn-loaded bass, an invention that led to a significant improvement in the acoustic quality of live concerts, and by extension, the number of transformative audio moments concertgoers could experience. Andrews also realized that while a decent home stereo, what used to be called hi-fi, had more than enough sound quality to shift consciousness, there were only so many bodies you could pack into a living room. If Andrews wanted to have a real impact, he needed to figure out how to bring that same high-quality sound to more people, to build a system capable of reproducing the audio moment at a stadium level. Then, he says, in my simplistic terms, people could have a common place to expand their minds. And when we had the opportunity to stand in front of a Function One sound stack at a recent concert, we got a clear sense of how far Andrews had come in perfecting his audio moment. The experience was less like listening to conventional music and more like getting pressure washed with a sonic fire hose. The bass hit our chests like a concussion grenade. The high notes made the hair on our necks stand up. And throughout the experience, there was no room for thinking at all. Of course, Andrews is by no means the first to connect the power of music to its ability to shift consciousness. In recent years, scientists have found that a great many of the world's oldest religious sites have peculiar acoustic properties. While studying the Arcy-sur-Cure caves in France, University of Paris music ethnographer Yegor Reznikov discovered that the largest collection of Neolithic paintings are found more than a kilometer deep. They'd been intentionally located at the most acoustically interesting spots in the cave, the parts with the most resonance. Reznikov's theory, writes author Stephen Johnson in How We Got to Now, is that Neanderthal communities gathered beside the images they had painted, and they chanted or sang in some kind of shamanic ritual, using the reverberations of the cave to magically widen the sound of their voices. When musicologists traced this trend through history, they found that what began in prehistoric caves also showed up in medieval churches. In Greece, churches were designed with narrow walls to produce a slap echo, sort of a threefold sound bounce meant to represent the flapping of an angel's wings. In France, the Gothic arches of Notre Dame and Chartres cathedrals act as giant subwoofers for the pipe organs. For thousands of years, we have been engineering sound to shift consciousness. In all societies, explains neurologist Oliver Sacks in the journal Brain, a primary function of music is collective and communal, to bring and bind people together. One of the most dramatic effects of music's power is the induction of trance states. Trance, ecstatic singing and dancing, wild movements and cries, perhaps rhythmic rocking or catatonia-like rigidity or immobility, is a profoundly altered state. And whilst it can be achieved by a single individual, it often seems to be facilitated in a communal group. Scientists working in the burgeoning field of neuromusicology have begun using high-powered imaging to decode these effects. When listening to music, brainwaves move from the high beta of normal waking consciousness down into the meditative and trance-inducing ranges of alpha and theta. At the same time, levels of stress hormones like norepinephrine and cortisol drop, while social bonding and reward chemicals like dopamine, endorphins, serotonin, and oxytocin spike. Add in entrainment, where people's brains sync to both the beat and to the brains of those around them, and you've got a potent combination for communitas. In a recent study, Apple and the speaker manufacturer Sonos took a deeper look at music's power to connect. To track how much music people listen to at home, on average 4.5 hours a day, and what happened while they listened, they rigged 30 homes with Sonos speakers, Apple Watches, Nest Cams, and iBeacons. When tunes were playing, the distance between housemates decreased by 12%, while chances of cooking together increased by 33%, laughing together by 15%, inviting other people over by 85%, saying I love you by 18%, and most tellingly, having sex by 37%. This also explains why the honor of opening the main stage at Portugal's 2014 Boom Festival, essentially Europe's version of Burning Man, didn't go to a movie star or rock star or famous DJ, and instead fell to Tony Andrews, a loudspeaker manufacturer. About 45 years ago, Andrews told that audience, I came to a place where I realized that big sound can facilitate our communal mind moving to a place of unity. I believe this is a really necessary step for humanity to take. Some 26,000 people attended Boom. As the entire festival grounds had been, thanks to Andrews and the Function One team, wired for big sound, nearly every one of them could experience that communal mind shift together. What we're building in the dance temple, explained one of its designers, is a piece of tech to disintegrate people's egos en masse. And this is the biggest change that new technology has afforded. Drums and voices only carry so far. There are only so many people you can cram into a cave or a church. But 26,000 people is somewhere between a large town and a small city. Electronic festivals in Las Vegas and Miami pack in over 250,000. Never before have so many people been able to come together and follow the beat right out of their minds. The Digital Shaman. One of Tony Andrews's collaborators at Boom Festival was Android Jones, an unassuming visual artist with a knack for arresting images. A veteran of George Lucas's Industrial Light and Magic, as well as the first non-Japanese illustrator at the legendary game maker Nintendo, Jones has established himself as one of the most prolific creators in the visionary art scene. Combining a classical fine arts education with the power of digital software, Jones creates images that defy easy categorization. archetypal deities overlaid with fractal geometries, cosmic lovers projected across giant galaxies, and ornate masks stretched across crystalline hillsides. At Boomfest, he live-painted his images onto huge screens as dancers writhed and stomped, creating an animated stained-glass window for the Church of Trance. In the same way that Function 1 is fine-tuning soundscapes, Jones is extending the impact of visual art. Since 2011, he has partnered with Obscura Digital to project his images onto iconic public buildings around the world. On the Sydney Opera House, for instance, he live-painted during a performance by the YouTube Symphony Orchestra. He's also transformed the Empire State Building, the United Nations headquarters, and most recently, St. Peter's Basilica at the Vatican. Digital projection mapping has created unparalleled possibilities, Jones says. It takes art out of museums and brings it directly to people going about their daily lives. The scale of access it provides outpaces anything available in the past. In the past, sacred art was viewable only in sacred places. If you wanted to look at prehistoric bulls, you'd have to descend into the caves of Lascaux. Only the faithful making the pilgrimage to Rome could view Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel in situ. The fact that Jones's artwork lives in a computer file and not stretched on canvas offers many more opportunities for display. When the goddess Kali is 40 stories high on the side of the Empire State Building, or a God's Eye montage of the planet's history is projected onto the side of the Vatican, people can encounter the sacred in the midst of the mundane. And visionary art is not only becoming much more accessible. With the Internet, it's becoming interactive as well. It's impossible to separate the feedback I get, online or in person, from the creative process itself, says Jones. It's no longer just a one-way experience. I get all this non-verbal feedback, likes, shares, etc., that directly informs the work. The feedback isn't all likes and retweets, either. Android frequently reinterprets religious symbols and sacred iconography, riffing on thousands of years of culturally loaded imagery. For this, Jones has been dubbed a pop shaman, but not everyone welcomes the impact his high-fidelity visuals can have. Beginning with his Empire State and UN installations, and then spiking after the exhibit at the Vatican, Android has spawned a lively cottage industry of YouTube conspiracies. He stands accused of everything from smuggling pagan idolatry into the church's holy sites to programming unsuspecting minds with images from the Illuminati. One particularly cautious whistleblower considered Jones's art so psychoactive that he wrote, "I cannot even continue to view these images, even for the purposes of alerting others as to their true intent." "At first I was laughing it off," explains Jones. "How funny people are and desperate to make meaning, making random speculations. But it isn't just speculation. There's something happening to viewers on an objective level." Research conducted at Stanford supports Jones's hunch. A 2012 study found that encounters with perceptual vastness, be it the endless spiral of galaxies in the night sky or Jones's larger-than-life projections, triggers a self-negating, time-dilating sense of awe. And this happens automatically, which means an encounter with Jones's projections could be enough to drive subjects into a deeply altered state, willingly or not. In March 2015, Jones upped the impact of his work even further, joining forces with a group of Russian monks living in Thailand, who improbably happened to be tech whizzes. He moved from projecting his art onto flat 2D surfaces into fully immersive 3D experiences. The coder monks crafted Jones's original media files into a string of modular scenes. When stitched together and projected onto the smooth 360-degree canvas of an enclosed geodesic dome, the screen seems to extend far beyond the physical space. Rather than looking up at the curved vault of the Sistine Chapel to view a singular mural, you can now walk through an immersive and infinitely changeable landscape, a dream state filled with gods and demons, stardust and galaxies, and anything else Jones can dream up. After working in this 3D immersive space, he admits, it's really challenging to go back to creating images that are on a rectangle hanging on a wall. I never realized how limiting the frames were. And he's not the only one exploring these possibilities. Virtual and augmented reality companies like Oculus and Magic Leap are attracting outsized media and investor attention as everyone rushes into the landscape beyond frames and screens. They are early indicators of a new way of consuming content that increasingly blurs the boundaries between what is real and what is simulated. But perhaps more than any other artist, Jones is taking advantage of this technology to knock people out of their normal frames of reference and give them a glimpse of ecstasy. His most recent project, appropriately named Microdose VR, is an immersive VR game offering an Adam's Eye tour through many of Shulgin's alphabetamine compounds. Zooming through that digital world, surrounded by deep trance music and the actual molecules of desire, the simulation is more than enough to knock you out of regular awareness. That's probably the real value of these experiences, explains Jones. They take us out of our conditioned world. They open a realm of everything else we might never have experienced and only dreamed of. You think you know where the boundaries are, but you see this stuff and think, if this thing I'm looking at is possible, what else might be possible? Enlightenment Engineering. In 2011, Mikey Siegel, an MIT and NASA-trained roboticist, was living in Silicon Valley and working his dream job. It was engineering heaven. I got to build robots, design systems, code software, create my own experiments, and they paid me really well. I had a long list of everything I thought I wanted, and everything on that list was ticked off. But everything wasn't cutting it. Siegel felt anxious and unfulfilled, like his life had little substance, like, as he explains, his soul was bankrupt. So he did what the unfulfilled have often done, went on a quest. He trekked through the jungles of South America and visited ashrams in India. His perspective shifted, but the vision he'd been questing for never arrived. That changed on a 10-day meditation retreat in the California desert. It was day 7, and participants were 70 minutes into a focus exercise, trying to pay attention to bodily sensations without passing judgment. But Siegel was overwhelmed by sensations. After a week of cross-legged meditation, his back ached, his neck throbbed, and his thighs were numb. It was an all-consuming pain, he explains, and all I was doing was judging. And then he wasn't. Something inside him shifted. The part of his brain that had been judging suddenly turned off. It felt like freedom, he explains. If pure freedom feels like anything, that's what I was feeling. It was the most clear, present, and aware I had ever been. And if I could be in extreme pain and still remain peaceful and clear, then I thought maybe other people could do this too. In that instant, everything I believed about human potential shifted. It felt like a life-changing realization. But when Siegel got home from that retreat and returned to his normal routine, he couldn't integrate what he'd learned. It didn't matter how dedicated he was. The meditation practices he was trying to use were designed in a different time and for a different world. In the world I lived in, he says, I was surrounded by technology and information that seemed to be pulling me in a very different direction. That's when Siegel realized that meditation was simply a tool meant to provoke a very specific reaction in the brain. But it wasn't the only tool available. In fact, considering all the recent advances in brain science and wearable sensors, meditation was pretty low-tech. So Siegel decided to build better tools, birthing the field that has come to be called Enlightenment Engineering. One of his early prototypes converted heart rate into audio tone. He was building on older research that showed prayer, yoga, and meditation could produce clear changes in heart rate. "I wore the thing for 3 days straight," recounts Siegel. "Even when I slept, it was annoying. Beep, beep, boo, beep, and on and on. But at the end of that period, just by working with this very thin slice of audio feedback, I learned to control my heartbeat. I could move it from 40 beats per minute up to 80 and back again. It wasn't much more than a novelty toy, but it showed me what might be possible." Since then, research has exploded. Scientists all over the world are exploring contemplative practices, Siegel explains. They're mapping a territory. And a whole slew of researchers, myself included, have begun using that map to create what you could call tech-assisted self-awareness devices, or devices that can help us tune our internal environments. In his work with heart rate variability, Siegel's found that by upgrading the tone to include a visual display and adding in an EEG layer, so there's neurofeedback to go along with the biofeedback, he can get whole groups of people to synchronize their heart rates and brain waves and drive them into group flow. His new challenge is to take this same technology and make an affordable version that's available to everyone. He's also been moving beyond heart rate, investigating ultrasound, transcranial magnetic stimulation, and transcranial direct stimulation. These devices shoot pulses into the brain and can turn on and off cortical regions with relative precision. "Right now," he says, "it's early days. So we have stuff that can make you feel like you've drunk a glass of wine. It's not quite what decades of meditation training can produce, but it's legitimate, reliable, and repeatable state change." Since Siegel was living in Silicon Valley, he was obliged to form a company, Consciousness Hacking, around these ideas. He, alongside Nicole Bradford and Jeffrey Martin, also co-founded the Transformative Technology Conference and started organizing consciousness hacking meetups. In about 9 months, with exactly zero spent on marketing, what began with a handful of people in one Northern California location has become a network of more than 10,000 people in 23 locations worldwide. In June 2015, his efforts scored him a feature in The New Yorker. Stanford University has taken notice, too. Siegel is now teaching courses on this emerging field to undergraduates. "For the past 300 years, Siegel explains, there has been a split between science and religion. But now we have the ability to investigate this domain and innovate around spirituality. And whether you're judging by the growth of our meetups, the millions of dollars hitting this market, or the technology that's already available, lots of us are really interested in spiritual innovation." And if Siegel's predictions are correct, we've barely scratched the surface. Consciousness hacking technology is going to become as dynamic, available, and ubiquitous as cell phones. Imagine what happens if we can use personal technology to shift these experiences on demand, to support and catalyze the most important changes we can make at scale. More and more, it's looking like we can retune the nervous system of the entire planet. The Flow Dojo. Across the board, we're seeing an explosion in technologies that provide more people with more access to ecstasy than before. We now have sports equipment that gives mere mortals the chance to cheat death and chase flow. Sound systems that entrance and entrain hundreds of thousands of people at once. Immersive art that transforms waking reality into an interactive dream state. And biohacking tools that steer us toward tech-enabled transcendence. Each of these breakthroughs makes stepping outside of ourselves easier, safer, and more scalable than ever. Despite these developments, there's still a lot of untapped potential. Part of the trouble is that all of these disciplines, sport, music, art, and biotech, have distinct subcultures and favored applications. While it's fairly common to see a couple of these combined, music and visuals are an obvious pairing, as are athletics and wearable sensors. Putting them all together into one deliberately designed experience isn't typically done. But it can be. As powerful as these advancements are independently, when blended together, their impact is amplified considerably. It's why, over the past several years, we've been collaborating with some of the top experienced designers, biohackers, and performance specialists to help develop the Flow Dojo, a training and research center explicitly designed to merge these technologies in one place. Equal parts Cirque du Soleil, X Games, and Hands-On Science Museum, it's a learning lab dedicated to mapping the core building blocks of optimum performance. In the fall of 2015, we had the opportunity to bring a prototype of the dojo to Google's Silicon Valley headquarters and engage in a joint learning project. For 6 weeks, a hand-picked team of engineers, developers, and managers committed to a flow training program and then capped that off with 2 weeks in a beta version of the training center. The premise was simple. If you train your body and brain and manage your energy and attention, you'll be able to get into flow more frequently and perform better at work and at home. Each day, participants engaged in a range of activities, from sleep tracking to diet and hydration, to functional movement designed to undo the imbalances of desk-bound lives, to brain and training audio and respiration exercises. With just those basic practices, subjects reported a 35% to 80% increase in incidence of flow during their workdays. The bigger surprise for the engineers was that they also experienced more flow at home, where family dynamics were frequently less rational and predictable than the algorithms they played with at work. Once that foundation was in place, we got to the interesting part, the dojo itself. In our research for The Rise of Superman, we had interviewed more than 200 professional and elite adventure athletes to figure out their secret to getting into flow so readily. Time after time, they told us it came down to two things, the right triggers and gravity. And that's where the team began the design of the Flow Dojo. Was it possible to use technology to simulate those conditions in a safer and more accessible way? Could we take a page out of Alan Metney's iFly book and recreate the embodiment and consequences that the world's best flow hackers relied on, to give regular folks a taste of the state? By combining Tony Andrews' sound design, Android Jones's digital imagery, and Mikey Siegel's brain tech, could we construct a novel and interactive environment? If so, we could guide users into peak states, and researchers could capture invaluable data along the way. This would provide a unique opportunity to study the impact of wearables, experience design, and user biometrics, all in the same place. We could literally start reverse engineering the genome of peak performance states. So we brought together a team of engineers to develop kinetic training gear that could deliver those experiences. Think extreme playground equipment built for grown-ups. Giant looping swings that send you upside down and 20 feet off the ground, and pull more than 3 Gs when you push through the arc's bottom. Momentum-powered gyroscopes and surf swings, complete with Doppler sound effects and LED cues that let you flip, spin, and twist without risking a hospital visit. The designers also integrated sensors and audio-visual feedback into the gear, so users get real-time data on physics, like G-force, RPM, and amplitude, and personalized biometrics, like EEG, HRV, and respiration. Taking that kind of data off smartwatches and laptops and away from the conscious mental processing of the prefrontal cortex gets users out of themselves and into the zone with less distraction. Even so, when Sergey Brin, one of Google's co-founders, stepped up to the looping swing, we were unsure how it was going to go. Brin is an action sports enthusiast, pursuing everything from base jumping to kite surfing. At the TED conference a few years ago, he also topped the leaderboard on an EEG mindfulness training demo. So while he already had some experience in both the physical and mental elements of this training, he had never put the two together. First, we hooked him up to a heart rate variability monitor to establish a cardiac baseline. Then he strapped into the kiteboard bindings and began pumping the looping swing higher and higher. Most people encounter two limits on this device. The first is when they reach the highest point they ever attained on a playground swing, typically about 50 degrees. If they can push past that long-known safe zone, the next limit is actually when they're straight upside down and needing to drive their weight forward, against all better judgment when you're 20 feet off the ground, to push the swing through a full revolution. Brin pumped past both of those limits, looping the swing. Only about 5% of subjects managed that feat on their first attempt, and then proceeded to stall the swing at its apex and loop it blind and backward. When we compared his biofeedback data from his sessions to his baseline, he had lost coherence when he was initially exerting himself, but had regained an organized brain and heart rhythm once his body knowledge figured out how to adapt and adjust. His only comment when he returned back to Earth, "I want one in my backyard." Brin's instinct to keep training these skills is supported by the data. Embodied cognition research shows that we become more flexible and resilient when we train our bodies and brains together, and in increasingly dynamic situations. It's why the SEALs say, you don't ever rise to the occasion, you sink to your level of training, and then proceed to overtrain for every scenario possible. It's a more advanced corollary to Amy Cuddy's power posing advice. Once you get the basics down, start upping the ante. Try remaining centered under more challenging conditions, like managing heart and brain activity while swinging upside down. If we want to train for stability in all conditions, the science suggests, it's essential to practice with instability first. Later in the visit, Google's other founder, Larry Page, gave one of Mikey Siegel's newest creations a try. A mix of 3D surround sound and visual feedback designed to prompt connection between people. Sitting in an enclosed dome, he and his wife put on small backpack subwoofers, so they literally felt the bass through their bodies, not their ears. They then watched two digital flowers blossom and contract on the screen surrounding them. But there was a trick to the setup. Larry was feeling his wife's heartbeat and watching his flower pulse to her heart's rhythms, and she was watching and feeling his. By deliberately crossing the feedback loops, the installation creates technologically mediated empathy. No talking required. So absorbing was the experience that when the nighttime sprinklers came on and accidentally sprayed them, they just assumed it was part of the simulation. While the field of immersive experience design and training is in its infancy, early results, like this project at Google, suggest that by combining all of the advancements in technology, movement, sound, light, and sensors, with an embodied hands-on training program, you can trigger a range of non-ordinary states with far more precision and with much less risk. In the past, to get a glimpse of no self, it might have taken a high-risk wingsuit flight, a decade of monastic isolation, or a heroic and possibly reckless dosage of an unpredictable substance. Today, we can use innovations like the Flow Dojo to skillfully tweak and tune the knobs and levers of our bodies and brains and get similar breakthroughs with a fraction of the breakdowns. And really, that's the true power of technology and the four forces in general. They give more people more access to ecstasy in safer and more approachable ways. Without the shift in psychology, the notion of harnessing altered states toward practical ends would have seemed crazy. But we now know they can heal trauma, amplify creativity, and accelerate personal development. Without advances in neurobiology, mystical experiences would have remained just that, mystifying. But we now know the precise adjustments to body and brain function that let us recreate them for ourselves. Without the progress in pharmacology, our exploration of non-ordinary states would have remained constrained by geography, church, and state. But we now know that a wide range of compounds disclose potentially revelatory information and insight. Without the developments in technology, too few were forced to risk too much to glimpse the value inherent in altered states. But we now know how to prime and prompt these experiences safely and at scale. Driven by these changes, our understanding of ecstasy is now advancing at an exponential rate. Findings in one domain are informing and supporting developments in others. Research has been open-sourced, access has been democratized, and, as will become much clearer in Part 3 of this book, proof that these four forces are driving a revolution is everywhere you look. Part 3. The Road to Eleusis. The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. William Blake. Chapter 8. Catch a Fire. The Sandbox of the Future. If gizmos and gadgets are your thing, then the annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas is your pilgrimage. If it's superheroes and graphic novels, then it's San Diego's Comic-Con. But if you're stalking ecstasy, if you want to see the four forces cranked up and deployed for full effect, then head out to that same desert festival Larry Page and Sergey Brin used to screen Eric Schmidt, Burning Man. Every year, some 3 hours northeast of Reno, on a vast alkali flat known as the Black Rock Desert, you'll find all the major players from Part 2 of this book. There's Tony Andrews in Purple Paisley, bumping bass out of a Function 1 art car. Mikey Siegel's around, too, demonstrating neurofeedback to the dusty and the curious. Android Jones has erected a giant dome to display his trance-inducing visionary art. There are workshops by world-renowned sex therapists, lectures on neurotheology by Ivy League scientists, and every head-bending alphabetamine Sasha Shulgin ever dreamed up. Off in the distance, you might even spot the Red Bull Air Force, dressed up in flaming costumes and wingsuiting into the city. Whatever else can be said about the event, Burning Man holds the undisputed title as the world's largest ecstatic trade show. Burning Man aggressively extends the tradition of hedonic ecstasy, writes Eric Davis. Wild visuals, disorienting sonics, and a self-conscious excess of sensory stimulation all help undermine stabilized frames. It's a full sensorium brain machine designed to bring us in tune with our mind's ongoing construction of real time on the fly. Michael Michaels, one of Burning Man's original founders and known as Danger Ranger at the event, explains it this way. At Burning Man, we found a way to break out of the box that confines us. What we do, literally, is take people's reality and break it apart. Burning Man is a transformation engine. It has hardware, and it has software. You can adjust it and tweak it, and we've done that. We take people out to this vast, dry place, nowhere, very harsh conditions. It strips away their luggage, the things they've brought with them, of who they thought they were. And it puts them in a community setting where they have to connect with each other, in a place where anything is possible. In doing so, it breaks their old reality and helps them realize they can create their own. In other words, it's a transformation engine tailor-made to invoke the selflessness, timelessness, effortlessness, and richness of STIR, Increasingly, that transformation engine has been producing real change in the world. And that's the point of this chapter. If the past section examined the emergence of the four forces, this one asks the next obvious question. Is the radical inspiration the forces provide leading to practical innovation? Earlier, we explored studies that demonstrated non-ordinary states can meaningfully boost creativity and problem-solving under controlled conditions. Here we want to step outside the lab and see if ecstasis is helping solve wicked problems in the wild. And Burning Man is perhaps the best place to begin this inquiry. The first thing to note is who's showing up at the festival. Unlike in the Woodstock era, attendees are no longer just countercultural bohemians who have tuned in, turned on, and dropped out. For sure, there are still plenty of punk anarchists, industrial artists, and warehouse denizens for whom life in the mainstream is a sometimes awkward fit. But today, the ranks of burners, as attendees call themselves, include members of a high-powered subculture, a tech-nomadic glitterati that have access to capital, markets, and global communication platforms. When Tim Ferriss mentioned that nearly all of the billionaires he knows in Silicon Valley take psychedelics to help themselves solve complex problems, Burning Man is one of their preferred locations to step out and go big. If you haven't been to Burning Man, you just don't get Silicon Valley, serial entrepreneur and longtime attendee Elon Musk noted in Recode. You could take the craziest LA party and multiply it by 1,000, and it doesn't even get fucking close. Among certain circles, mention of the Playa or Black Rock City gains you instant camaraderie with those who have shared that baptism by fire. Participation in successful Burning Man camps has morphed from countercultural street cred to career-building material. So embedded, so accepted has Burning Man become in parts of tech culture, wrote journalist Vanessa Hua in the San Francisco Chronicle, that the event alters work rhythms, shows up on resumes, is even a sanctioned form of professional development. All signs that the norm has adopted parts of the formerly deviant happening. Over the last decade in particular, the festival has become a regular stop for those whose calendar might include Davos, TED, and a slew of other high-profile gatherings. In 2013, John Perry Barlow, a fellow at Harvard Law School and former lyricist for The Grateful Dead, casually tweeted from Burning Man, "Spent much of the afternoon in conversation with Larry Harvey, mayor of Burning Man, and General Wesley Clark, who is here. At one of the more infamous parties on the planet, countercultural royalty are hobnobbing with a former Supreme Commander of NATO, turned U.S. presidential candidate. 3 years later, the actual president, Barack Obama, joked about the event at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, saying, "Just recently a young person came up to me and said she was sick of politicians standing in the way of her dreams, as if we were actually going to let Malia go to Burning Man this year. Was not going to happen. Bernie Sanders might have let her go. Not us." If the President of the United States is moved to comment on the event, and Elon Musk is claiming it's central to Silicon Valley culture, then perhaps there's more going on than just a week-long party. And that's the second thing to explore in our assessment. Why so many creative and talented people go so far out of their way to congregate there once a year? By simple elimination, it can't just be the sex, drugs, or music. Those indulgences, however tantalizing, are little more than commodities in any major city. There must be a pretty compelling something that inspires people to take a week out of their calendars to wander around an inhospitable salt flat in the middle of absolute nowhere. Recent research conducted on Burning Man sheds some light on that something. In 2015, a team of scientists led by Oxford neuropsychologist Molly Crockett joined forces with the Black Rock City Census to take a closer look at the festival's power. In their study, 75% of attendees reported having a transformative experience at the event, while 85% of those reported that the benefits persisted for weeks and months afterward. That's an incredibly high batting average. 3 out of 4 people who attend the event are meaningfully changed by it.